Good evening, wherever you are. Thank you very much for joining us on the Just Like the Movies podcast. As always, it is a very special episode because most of the movies we pick are very special. We're talking about the very underrated, underrepresented, and overlooked Manhunter, kind of the progenitor of the Hannibal Lecter films in the ripe year of 1986. And thanks again for joining us. As always, we made an administrative decision to delay the podcast a week, so without much fanfare. So I guess we could have just played it off like we didn't, like nothing happened. But we like to keep it real here. But before we get into the meat of the topic, we always have to get to the first order of business, which is checking in with the main man. Johnny, how you feeling, man?
Good. It's funny when you think about the fact that Hannibal Lecter does the voiceovers for McDonald's. Dude, I'm a big... I've always liked Brian Cox. You know, we've talked about him a little bit on our X-Men podcast.
Super Troopers, Braveheart.
Yeah, of course, Super Troopers, and, you know, how he stepped in to play Stryker for X2, and, you know, he's and I liked that, maybe we'll get into this here, on our Super Troopers podcast, we sort of got into the conclusion that he doesn't worry about the prestige of a role. He just takes varying types of roles, from Johnny Knoxville's ringer to something of a more prestige award-seeking thing like in Succession. But a very talented actor, has a lot of similarities to Anthony Hopkins, right down to either agents or managers, I believe. So we'll tackle that stuff.
It was even to the point, it's one of those strange cosmic coincidences where they were both doing Julius Caesar, or no, not Julius Caesar, they were both doing King Lear at the same theater at the same time, like when each one was playing Hannibal Lecter for the first time.
It's very eerie. It's very interesting. And I think it's going to be fun, not diving too much into the Anthony Hopkins stuff, but definitely making a stark contrast between those versions of Lecter, because the one that everyone knows when you say Hannibal Lecter is Fava Beans, Nice Chianti, very characterized, iconic character with very significant traits, both physical and verbal, among others. But a different take from Brian Cox in the first one, so to speak, with Manhunter, and I actually enjoyed his performance. But overall, I'm doing all right. My Giants are officially tanking.
Yeah, that was rough, man.
Yeah, quarterback now with a torn ACL, so Daniel Jones, the era, I assume, is over. So now it's time to restart all over again, as your Chiefs just put along and win games as though it's easy to win NFL games.
I'm not going to complain, because I really thought the Dolphins, I thought that was going to be a Tyreek Hill track meet, and I thought they were going to lose that game for sure. So I was totally wrong about that. But yeah, that second half, the officiating this year has been the worst I've seen in my adult life. Like, it wasn't just that. Like, I was watching the Chiefs game, and then I was watching the Eagles game with my brother, because he's an Eagles fan. And The officiating in the second half of the Chiefs game, and in that, on that last drive where they basically just gave the Cowboys like 60 free yards and gave them like a fourth and goal from the 10 to end the game. It's like, I was shocked.
It is odd, but you know, I don't want to bore our audience too much.
Yeah, this isn't some half-assed NFL podcast. How often are we going to do that? Come on.
Seriously. But yeah, so hopefully one day, years from now, when someone's like, I wonder if there's any podcast about Manhunter. Hopefully when they click on this, the Giants are like 15-2 and just crushing everybody.
Well, they got to get an offensive line first.
Yeah, among other things. They have a kicker, but even he got hurt. So my team is completely effed, much like a lot of the families in this movie. So let's dive into Manhunter. Right out of the gate, just so we stay on brand and keep it real, as you like to say, haven't read any of the books, but I've seen all the movies in the franchise, including the remake, which is aptly titled, more accurately to the name of the book, Red Dragon. I actually watched some cool YouTube videos that I want people to check out that show the comparisons between some of the scenes that have a lot of verbatim dialogue, to see how, you know, Edward Norton played it versus William Peterson and so on. But and I know you, because of Heat, you know, I think you're more of a Michael Mann fan than I am, but I enjoyed watching the movie. I think it suffers a little bit from its time in terms of how it was put together and presented, because it feels a little dated, but it's still a very good movie. And some things that I forgot that I really enjoyed seeing, like Stephen Lang showing up with a bouffant.
Isn't it kind of funny how Stephen Lang really reinvented himself as this kind of like old tough guy? And it seemed like a lot of the roles he was in were kind of like this, where he's kind of like cowardly and like simpering. Yes. Like the only other things I really remember him from was this. And then he was in this movie called Guilty as Sin. And there was this scene where Don Johnson just beats the shit out of him in a parking garage. Like,
yeah, it's sort of like he's like Mickey Rourke, except he didn't fuck his face up.
Yeah, that cosmetic surgery, man. Don't do it.
It'll get you.
It'll get you. Do you remember, I didn't want to pass the buck on you, because I know I've done that the past couple movies. I pick a movie, and then I'm like, hey, what did you think of it? My experience with this movie was, I think I watched it on television, and then we would watch it on cable sometimes. And I have a lot of memories of like watching, especially the end sequence. But I did see that in 1991... And I can't say for certain if this ties into my childhood experience with it or not. But in 1991, NBC, because they wanted to gravy train off the Silence of the Lambs success, they did TV showings of Manhunter, but they called it Red Dragon, The Curse of Hannibal Lecter. And for anybody who's curious why this movie was called Manhunter as opposed to Red Dragon, which is the title of the book it was adapted from, it was because Dino De Laurentiis, who is he's like the head honcho, he's the executive producer of the Hannibal series, he owns all the cinematic rights and everything. He, for two reasons, he decided not to title the movie Red Dragon. One was because the year before, this movie called Year of the Dragon that had Mickey Rourke in it and John Lone flopped really hard. And also, he didn't want people to get confused and think it was a karate movie, so he called it Manhunter. I don't know if anybody thinks that bit of trivia is interesting, but I was always kind of curious because Brian Cox said in an interview that he thought the name was kind of cheesy and generic as opposed to Red Dragon. I don't know how much... I haven't really read any of the Hannibal Lecter books either. Shame on me, I guess. But I do think it's interesting Thomas Harris's career, how he's written so few books and they're all movies except for one of them.
Yeah, I find the title to be a bit... I don't know about lazy is the word, but it's strange anyway. And then you look at, you know, what they did later when they really found something with Silence of the Lambs and it took off as sort of this trilogy.
Yeah.
And they redid it and everything like that. So I know for a fact I did not see Manhunter till around the time I heard Red Dragon was being made, because I was defiant. Like, you know how I am with... the continuity and suspension of disbelief. I started with Silence of the Lambs, like most people did, who, if they're going to be honest, that was their introduction to the character, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back and say, so, you know, the hipster thing is to be like, well, have you seen Manhunter though? And, you know, and I get that now having watched it, but I definitely saw Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal, which I saw in theaters. And then I heard about Red Dragon. I'm like, all right, I'll go see I'll rent the first one and watch Manhunter to see what this is all about first. So I did that. And because I didn't like the idea of, no one else could play Hannibal Lecter but Anthony Hopkins. You know, he wins the Oscar for it, only 18 minutes on screen. Well, you know, all those iconic lines and he doesn't blink, the whole thing. And then, as you get older, at least me, I developed that appreciation for Brian Cox, you know, having seen him in other things that came out around the time I was introduced to Manhunter. And I do have a much more newfound appreciation for his take on the character now that I've abandoned myself from the stubbornness of saying like, well, it's that actor or nothing. So I will gladly say I enjoyed his take on Hannibal Lecter and the clear differences in what he brought to it than Anthony Hopkins did, which I think Brian Cox himself sort of said Anthony Hopkins made it more of an exaggerated, dramatic, theatrical character, where he played it a little more tepid and a little more of casual. And he wanted to approach his evil from a casual perspective, where Hannibal Lecter, you felt like at any moment he was going to bite your face off.
Yeah, that's a great point, because I was going to bring up that one of the things when I was revisiting this movie, because I watched it a lot when I was in, you know, like when I was a kid, and which I probably shouldn't have been watching it, but I like my memories of it are so fragmented. And then it was a staple in, you know, the with my friends in college. Like, we would always watch these movies, and we would watch, like I remember one of my friends who's a he's one of our followers on Twitter, Rob with two B's. He's a huge fan of Manhunter and the Brian Cox Hannibal Lecter portrayal. And part of it is because when I was watching it this time, it really struck me more how much more restrained and grounded this is compared to the direction they took it when Jonathan Demme directed Silence of the Lambs, and then the direction they took it after that. Especially when you watch, and it's a good show, don't get me wrong, and I thought it was going to be a train wreck, but they did a Hannibal TV show that was on NBC for three
Mads
seasons.
Mads Mikkelsen, right?
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen is great in that. But
yeah,
and you're getting three very different, between Manhunter, the other Thomas Harris novels adapted to film with Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal, and then you have Mads Mikkelsen. You have three very different incarnations, but Brian Cox's is definitely the one that's more grounded in reality. I mean, granted, he's still, I don't know, maybe I'm stepping out of line a little bit, but he still oozes intelligence and charisma, but it's not as baroque or over the top as Anthony Hopkins is.
Right.
And I think part of that is because they glossed over a lot of details from the book to focus more on on Will Graham and his process and his struggle. Because you got to remember, part of the legacy of this movie, even though it didn't do super well at the box office and it didn't have the crazy critical cachet that Silence of the Lambs did 5 years later, it did have it before people got so fascinated with murder porn and profiling and serial killers. Before that was like a really common thing. I mean, this was kind of that movie that introduced terms like profiling, and it had to show the more nuts and bolts of an investigation like this. Like Michael Mann did extensive research with the FBI and other police criminalistics units to try. Like, that's why when they have the scene, pretty underrated scene, I think, but maybe goes unappreciated by some, where they find the note in Hannibal Lecter's cell, and they want to examine it, they want to put it through all their paces, but they want to put it back before he knows that they looked at it. And they're doing all the fingerprint analysis, and this was all like state-of-the-art technology back in 1985 or 1986, whenever they filmed it. And that goes into one of Michael Mann's things, where he likes to show people doing stressful jobs but doing them professionally. So I thought that was like kind of an interesting part of the movie, that maybe that was something that really people weren't seeing a lot of before this came out. So it's kind of part of its legacy. But it's a little all over the place, because there's a lot of stuff to talk about with this movie. You have the characters, you have the enduring pop culture legacy, and then, like I mentioned, the different portrayals of Hannibal Lecter and how it's gone on and on, to the point where, I mean, Dino De Laurentiis, even the whole reason that Hannibal Rising movie exists is because he basically told Thomas Harris, it's like, well, we're going to make this movie with or without you.
Yeah.
Because he owned the rights. So Thomas Harris ended up writing a book, and of course it was probably the weakest. It's definitely the weakest of the properties, but I wanted to bring that up because I know some people might be interested in that. But, I don't even know where to start with this one, you know, because I thought it was interesting that, did you read anything about how Brian Cox, like his inspiration for the Hannibal Lecter portrayal?
So I saw an interview with him talking about it. And it wasn't all that long ago, actually. So it was more of a retrospective, but
okay.
I forget what he had said specifically and what he was trying to channel. But go ahead.
Well, he said there was a dual inspiration. It was Peter Manuel, who was a Scottish serial killer, and also his son, Alan, because that was actually Michael Mann's direction. He said, I don't know what the specific motivation was, but he said, I want you to play Hannibal Lecter like he's a British public school boy. And then I guess at the time, his son, who was also a working actor, was about that age, and he was in public school. So he kind of based... I was kind of curious about something, because how he... It seems like this incarnation of Hannibal, like I said, is more grounded and stuff like that, but he's also not as absurdly sophisticated as the Anthony Hopkins one is. And one of the things I noticed this time around when I was watching it is like, and I don't think this is a Brian Cox thing, because I've seen him in a lot of other things, but like, he has his mouth open a lot. And I don't know if that was kind of part of the acting choice to make it look like he just doesn't really care what's going on, or as you said, he's more casual. Do you think that all connects?
It could be. It could also be that, and this is complete speculation, but a character like Hannibal Lecter probably, especially the way he likes to steer conversations, and he probably has an idea of someone's thought as they're delivering it, and he's probably just chomping at the bit to respond or something.
I never thought of it like that. Yeah, that could definitely be it, because
he's always doing, like, you know, he'd be laying down and then he sits up, but he seems to always be sort of leaning forward with his head and focusing directly on Will, while Will maybe, you know, doting around a bit. And one thing I did pick up in an interview, which may lend itself to this conversation about his facial expressions and mannerisms, is William Peterson was talking about it. Again, very retrospective. It had to have been no more than 5 years ago, saying that where they filmed it was an actual station with a cell, and they purposely picked one with very tight quarters to make it feel stressful, and like there's nowhere you could go to alleviate the stress of the situation. And he said Michael Mann was very deliberate in how he shot it and which scenes he chose to be delivered from which person's side of the cell. So a lot of that went into it. So I would not be shocked at all if there was a very deliberate focus on exactly how he presented Hannibal Lecter. And I would say it's not just Brian Cox, but probably Michael Mann, like, putting a lot into that, because William Peterson said he was very, very focused in this scene in particular, where they're having their first real conversation in the movie, on every single shot, having very deliberate intentions.
Okay. All right, well, you brought up William Peterson, and he's the lead of this thing, and he definitely wasn't a big actor at the time. He was cast, it's who you know thing, because I guess he, Dennis Farina, and Michael Mann all grew up in the same area in Chicago. And they were both in his directorial debut, Thief, in smaller parts. I think William Peterson was a bouncer. I can't remember what. Dennis Farina was one of the cronies, I think, or maybe he was one of the detectives, because he used to be a Chicago detective before he became an actor. But William Peterson in this role, I mean, there was a, you know how much I love the alternate casting stuff, but with this one, it was just all these people were considered. This guy was considered. This guy was considered. The only real pieces of casting things that I think is really interesting is supposedly Timothy Dalton turned this down to be James Bond, and Kevin Kline also turned the part down.
That's interesting.
Yeah, not entirely sure how that would all play out, as great as Kevin Kline is. I just, every time I think about him, I think about A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah, I think Kevin Kline's a very underrated actor, because I think I've seen him in things where he can show a big, pretty wide range.
Did he get nominated for an Oscar for In-N-Out, or did I just remember?
I don't.
Or maybe Joan Cusack did.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah. Just if anything, I would think he would be nominated for A Fish Called Wanda, but.
Ken.
But yeah, I mean, those are interesting choices, no question about it. I've always liked Kevin Kline, so that one doesn't bother me as much. The one thing I'll say about William Peterson, I'm not going to sit here and say I think he's, you know, the greatest actor in the world. I think he definitely puts his foot on the accelerator when it's time to be all intense. And I think sometimes it feels a little forced, because I remember seeing that movie Fear, where he plays Reese Witherspoon's dad and the main.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's like the main adversary against Mark Wahlberg, who's this tough kid who kills people and stuff. And he brings that same type of energy It's like sort of manic, but not as well done as Michael Keaton. But I didn't really love William Peterson's Will Graham. I actually think that was one of the weaker parts of the movie.
That's interesting, because I thought. Yeah. Well, first of all, one thing that stood out to me, I was like, he was only 32 or 33 when they shot this thing, and he looking weathered. And I mean, and this is coming from a pair of guys who are pretty sensitive about how rapidly they're aging.
And how about Tom Noonan? Dolarhyde was like 34. I thought that guy was at least 50.
Yeah. But he was also huge, so it's kind of harder to age guys that are huge.
Do you see?
Yeah, and again, that's a much more. We'll talk about it a little more probably later, but that's way more subdued than Ray Fiennes took it.
And, oh yeah,
I mean they even made, and I think some of that was a lot of that was Michael Mann's direction, because they had in publicity shots and scenes in the movie that he had all the Red Dragon tattoos and it was part of his delusion, and which was featured a lot more heavily in the Brett Ratner version that came out in 2002. But
yeah,
they made the decision that it was just like, we kind of want to make this a little less goofy, because I to a certain extent I agree with you about William Peterson's performance, but at the same time, there were some difficulties, I think, that they had to kind of portray. Like, if you watch the Hannibal TV series, it's the Will Graham thought process is very affected. And it's something you have to kind of get past. Because if you're not into it, you're going to be like, man, this is dumb. But, like, in this movie, I could kind of give it a pass, because it's for a couple reasons. One is that if he's thinking out loud, it's for the audience, because maybe in the novel, I mean, I haven't read the novel, so I could be completely wrong, but maybe in the novel, like, a lot of this stuff was just his wheels spinning in his head. It's his internal monologue. And then it's like, what are you just going to show a guy like wandering around a house with a flashlight for 5 minutes, just staring at things. And then like the camera pans into it a certain way to show that maybe you get like a little sound cue, like do do do, like, oh, he felt that means something. Like, that would be fucking really cryptic. Like, that would be unbelievable. So, I kind of give it a pass for that reason, mainly. But also because I think that he doesn't really step it up too much until one of the scenes I really like is when he finally puts it all together. Like, the big epiphany scene where he figures out, like, basically cracks the case. And he's like, but right before that, you know, his boss, Dennis Farina's character, Jack Crawford, is like leaning on him about, hey man, why don't we, you know, we'll wait until, he basically told him like, we should just give up, wait until he kills again, and then we'll go to the next scene and it'll be fresh. And then he's like, he starts tearing into him about how he knew he'd be thinking about that family and the next one and the one after that when he came to see him. And he's like, until then, we're gonna go as late as I want to take it. And he's just like, and that's like the only time in the movie he's really like yelling. So I think I think a lot of it has to do with Michael Mann's direction. Like, a lot of the stuff may seem overly subdued, especially when you compare it to Silence of the Lambs or Red Dragon.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. Because Scott Glenn play the same character in Silence
yes.
of the Lambs? Wasn't he?
Yeah, he was Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs, and Harvey Keitel played him in the Red Dragon movie.
Right. So, rotating door there, very small part in Silence of the Lambs, but when you see him in Silence of the Lambs sort of having this same sort of, you know, business first mentality with Starling, maybe that's just how they wanted this character to be, which is, you know, execute first and you know, worry about your own personal shit later sort of thing. I don't know. I'm just, you know, trying to speculate on that. I always felt Dennis Farina is the type of guy, he's not a, I wouldn't say he's typecast, but he always seems to play kind of an asshole.
Yeah.
And I,
yeah, like, so, hard-nosed, like, even when he's a criminal, whether he's a criminal or a cop, like, if he was in, like, whether he's in Get Shorty or Snatch or this,
yeah,
or that one season of Law and Order that he was on inexplicably, and he played this really cool, mysterious character, and then he just as mysteriously was gone.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who's Law and Order fans who tune in, but...
Well, then also, Peterson was in, not Law and Order, but like CSI.
Yeah, this kind of was like the... that kind of laid the groundwork for what became his most iconic role, because, I mean, there was about 14, 15 years before he got cast in CSI, and he was in some, like you mentioned, Fear. I kind of forgot he was in that. He was in this one movie I saw, came out in the late 90s or early 2000s. It was called Gunshy, and he played like this washed up writer who, I'm sure I'm like the only person who saw it, but it was, he played this washed up writer who meets up with this mob enforcer who's played by Michael Wincott, and then he falls in love with his girlfriend who's played by Diane Lane.
I've seen Unfaithful like four times, and that's like four times too many. Like, it's just like, did I not want to watch porn that day or something? I just wanted to watch Diane Lane get just sort of on the job.
Just watch Diane Lane get pounded in a bathroom stall. It's like,
yeah, and then have Richard Gere beat someone to death with a snow globe. You know, the usual.
That old chestnut.
Yeah, Diane Lane, my own. You seem to know a bit more about the career, at least, of William Peterson. Did you find, sort of like I did, the tendencies of him as an actor appearing in this, or do you agree more with what you were saying, that it was more the author of the book inserting what he wanted here? Or is Michael Mann the type of person who, like he would with Heat, be very deliberate and get what he wanted out of his actors for his specific roles?
I'm not sure about all that. I mean, there's kind of a lot going on, but I would say that I think when you were talking about the scenes, the thing you watched, comparing the scenes, similarities in Red Dragon and Manhunter, I mean, Manhunter's definitely less faithful to the book than Red Dragon is, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that just comes from the source material. You know, some of the lines and some of the affectations. Like you said that some of the stuff might come off as a little, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but some of the stuff might come off as a little cheesy. But one of the good character moments, I thought, with Will Graham was how they established that he was able to get inside the heads of these crazy people, and he kind of hated himself for it. And then he ended up hating them. But then at the same time, he felt sympathy or empathy for them. And they make a much bigger deal out of that on the Hannibal TV show. Like, one of the things I noticed, I mean, it does seem a little cheesy when a guy is saying, like, when he's, like, talking and he's, like, trying to talk through what he thought he was doing. He's like, that's what you did, isn't it? Isn't it, you son of a bitch? That became, like, a little mini meme with me and my college friends. But then later in the movie, he starts saying, isn't that what you do, my man? And it's not only the fact that he's getting closer to him, but it's like he's understanding him more. Like, closer to catching him, but then he's also understanding him more.
I like that. Yeah, yeah.
So,
okay.
While that one thing could be like, oh, that's a little cheese dick or whatever, but then it kind of sets up for, I think, a pretty good payoff.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't find the Tooth Fairy all that scary. I think it almost felt like, I don't know if you ever watched the show Twin Peaks, but there were elements of this movie that made me feel like it was sort of made by David Lynch,
like,
or something.
Well, David Lynch was the first guy they talked to direct this, and he didn't want to do
it. That's interesting.
he said it was degenerate and violent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's always funny when a director takes a stance like that, and you just, it's like, that guy? The guy who directed Mulholland Drive and Lost Highway said that?
Yeah, like Twin Peaks is outrageous. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people love that show. That show is outrageous.
I don't think I could get through it. Like, I tried to watch it. I think I kept falling asleep.
When it started just getting weird, and they played like the same one song from the score over and over again, and even a healthy looking Laura Flynn Boyle could not save that show for me.
Yeah, and they ran it back like 5 or 6 years later, didn't they? They did a remake.
Oh. Yeah, they did that. They did a sequel season 2 years ago, or movie or whatever. Then they brought Kyle MacLachlan back. But back to this. I can't put my finger on what, like, I'm not going to sit here and say I loved the movie, but I enjoyed it a lot, and I've probably only seen it 3 or 4 times. And my takeaways from it now more than ever, because I can only speak to it as who I am now, is like Brian Cox a lot more than I did previously, like William Peterson a bit less than I did before. And I think Tom Noonan's Dolarhyde is a bit ridiculous. And I know we talk about how the Anthony Hopkins versions of these movies are a bit more theatrical and dramatic. And that, I think that's what Brian Cox was saying about Anthony Hopkins, is that he's more of a theatrical actor and he wants to bring certain specific nuances to his character. But there's something about the Dolarhyde, like I, when I'm comparing the characters, I, you know, and the actors of who played which, I feel like Red Dragon overall had a stronger cast. But I would put Brian Cox's Lecter toe to toe with Anthony Hopkins, and I wouldn't feel even pressured to debate that. So I think that's strong in itself. I know he doesn't have a ton of screen time or anything like that.
That's kind of the formula, at least in the first two books. And, well, movies, I don't know about the books themselves, but I'm sure because they have more backstory. But in the movies, I mean, yeah, it's, there's not a lot of Hannibal Lecter. I mean, he's in like three scenes in this.
Yeah, and but they're all impact.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about some of the best scenes in this movie, like his scenes do stand out to me. Him with the phone, him clearly with the one-on-one with Peterson. Later on in the movie when he gets his final scene, and you know, him talking about, you know, the exchanges via the paper and all that stuff. But as I think about that comparison scene, it's on YouTube, it's like 5 minutes and it pauses in between each one, but if there's any point in time where there's verbatim dialogue, they'll play it together. And more than anything, the Will Graham dialogue is almost identical. And the Hannibal Lecter stuff is where they played around a little bit. And that's when you could tell the departures between the two actors' versions. So I'm beginning to wonder if, you know, Will Graham was like, you got to play this way. We want to keep that, the tree, the foundation, the unmovable part, and everything else around it, we can maybe play around a little bit, especially depending on what type of actor we're getting to play Lecter or whoever else, even if it's his wife or, you know, Joan Allen's character, Reba?
Yeah.
Is that her name? Reba. Yeah, so and I thought she was great, actually, too. I thought Joan Allen did a great job in this movie. So, but I don't know what you think about that or what you make about that or how much you care about that, but I think it seems like our main protagonist here, which may be an old school thing, if you're doing an adaptation from a novel, is to keep that as close to the source material out of fear of not diverting too much. Because if you take your protagonist and really start twisting it, then it becomes something else entirely.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they took a lot less liberties with the Will Graham part between the movies. Now, I didn't watch Red Dragon or anything because I kind of... I liked Red Dragon well.
You've never seen it?
No, I've seen it. I saw it in the theater,
oh, okay.
But like...
Okay. And
this is nothing against the guy because he's famous. Well, he was famous at one point. He was a working Hollywood director. But, I mean, Michael Mann and Brett Ratner, like, come on. Like,
agreed.
What are we doing? But...
Agreed.
And, as great as Edward Norton is, I didn't think he was quite right for that Will Graham part. He just
seemed
a little young... Or like a little naive, yeah. Maybe, or something. I don't...
And
go ahead.
Also, didn't it... Just real quick. To me, it felt weird because I felt like he was almost playing the Richard Gere part from the movie where he played the psycho, the schizophrenic.
Oh, Primal... Yeah. It seemed,
Primal Fear.
It seemed like
Primal
a spiritual
Fear.
Sequel to Primal Fear because of his, because he was so... That was his breakout role in so many... Yeah, dude, that's a great that's a great comparison because I couldn't put my finger on it, but yeah, that did bug me at the time.
Yeah, and I forgot that sort of bugged me, and now when I look back at it, I'm like, he's sort of playing like... as though he is now the one interrogating the version of his character in this, you know, universe or whatever. And they gave him like the sandy blonde hair and you know, it's, I do agree that, as much as I'll criticize, you know, William Peterson, the more we're talking about this, and I guess that's where I'm going with this podcast, is I'm sort of maybe shifting and evolving, not like, you know, Dolarhyde is, let's be clear about that. But, shifting my thoughts on this because I took a shot at William Peterson a bit earlier, but now I'm beginning to wonder if it's more of just the character and he did what was asked of him and it wasn't necessarily his acting style, but more so what they just wanted out of Will Graham.
I think if you compare this to the later Hannibal Lecter movies, I think a criticism people might make is they might think the performances are kind of flat, but as I mentioned, I just think that's more Michael Mann wanting the movies to be more grounded. And to kind of tie it all together, like your criticism of Tom Noonan's character, I kind of liked in this one how they didn't, there was less of a focus on him because he doesn't even show up till almost an hour in the movie, which works both to kind of create that mystique and it works thematically, because if you have an investigator that's trying to track down this elusive serial killer and you're interspersing scenes with him for the entire movie because you want him to get his screen time, it doesn't add up. Like, one of the things I thought was funny from the Tom Noonan casting story was that part of the reason he got the part was because he showed up and he goes, "Hey, can we just not do the small talk? Can I just read my lines?" And they thought that kind of made him, that apparently he picked up on, he was doing the Freddie Lowndes torture scene and there was some woman there, like a PA or something, I don't know who she was, but apparently she was uncomfortable and he picked up on that and he started like trying to actively creep her out more. So I think those two things kind of got him cast. I think that...
Wow.
Yeah. And he kind of did the whole method thing where he had people call him by his name on set and he didn't want to meet William Peterson until they did their last scene together, which I don't know. I guess you could say if you're being less charitable or diplomatic, you could say that's kind of douchey, but at the same time, it kind of creates... I don't know. It seems like the result, that preparation didn't really pan out for you in the results.
Yeah, and you know, maybe part of the what's the word I'm looking for is the expectation of what you think you're going to get with that character is something more menacing, and he just seemed, and it's no offense to the actor, you know, whatever, but he just seemed a little too doofy to pull off something like that. And just his whole presentation, his physical, everything about him, from his physical look to his sort of, like, I actually like the scenes best of him when he's with her and he's sort of trying to cope with his weirdness. I think he did a better job with that than any of the actual menace that he was creating. Even at the end, I don't know that I was buying it. But I think what Mann does good is delivering the crime scenes and the horror without us needing to see him doing the killing. But we know he did this.
Yeah, I was trying to get there and I just didn't. But yeah, I liked how they kind of de-emphasized, like, we didn't actually see any of the murders or some of the more... like, I didn't, not until I saw Red Dragon, because I did, like as we've established a couple of times, we didn't read the books, but we didn't do the required reading, but in the Red Dragon movie, they made it clear that those crime scenes were a lot grislier. Like, he was taking pieces of mirror and like jamming them in people's eyes and their mouths, and that was like part of his delusion and stuff. And I'm kind of glad that it was almost like they kind of de-emphasized the serial killer. Like, yeah, they showed him and they gave him his background and stuff, but they didn't get into all the crap about how he was, like, that Red Dragon got into. Like, he was abused, and they kind of, like, everything was kind of subtle. Like, his whole thing about, like, the whole thing about how he has the big fake teeth. You only really know that because there's the one scene where the police are talking about it, and then there's the one scene where he puts them in. But then you don't even really see what he does with them, like, because they don't really linger on the macabre details about what he does, because I think Mann focuses more on the procedural part than kind of the sensationalistic, ritualistic, violence shit, as opposed to... But if you watch the Brett Ratner Red Dragon, there's a lot more of that in there, and if you watch the Hannibal TV series, there's a fuckload more of it. Like, it's really... That's more of the central... That's more than, like, just the central conceit of the thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think Michael Mann's subtlety maybe doesn't get the credit it deserves for this type of thing, because we do have the opportunity to compare it to another movie of a high stature, which is, you know, rare, because just when we were doing Halloween, our comparisons were Rob Zombie's Halloween, which neither of us liked, that he did do that with Michael Myers, which is say, like, oh, he was abused, you see, and it's this, that, and the other. And Michael Mann just got to it, and, you know, it was that whole thing where you don't need to give this backstory, you don't need to create empathy for this villain. He's just our villain. Evil, dumb, whatever you want to say, how we like it.
Crazy, yeah.
Crazy, no doubt. I do like the fact that they left in, not left in, but in both iterations, they use Hannibal Lecter saying, well, if I'm so brilliant, how did you catch me? And he said, and they say, you have
disadvantages.
You have disadvantages. And what are those? You're insane. And both movies do it. And it's almost like both actors show this sense of satisfaction in being told that. But anyway, Brian Cox, wonderful job. But yeah, back to the villain and how they portrayed that. You know what it made me think of a little, Mike, and I don't know about you, but watching the murder scenes post them happening, so we're seeing them as the police are seeing them, sort of, it brings you into it. I felt like I was a part of it, the crime scene, but also it made me think of the beginning and peppered throughout The Fugitive, and how we saw, like, his wife. We didn't necessarily see everything about her getting killed by the one-armed man. We see flashes of it, but we really start by almost the end result, which is her bleeding and on the ground and everything. And it almost makes your mind wonder, how did it happen? Whereas, like, in Manhunter, we see the point of view of the Tooth Fairy or Dolarhyde, wherever you want to call him, with that flashlight. So we see the guy waking up out of bed. And, like, in my mind, I'm like, putting myself in his shoes, like, what would I do right now? And that makes me more fearful as I'm watching the movie. So it's a very strong tactic to do a POV shot of the killer. I don't think that's used as much anymore. But again, Halloween did that, and they did it very well here in this movie too with Manhunter. And I think they probably executed it better than in Red Dragon. And to your point, maybe because of subtle things like that as opposed to going over the top. But I think movies in the early 2000s, and I don't know about since then, but I think that era of movies, there was this obligation to really show a lot, and I think they've dialed that back more these days. So that peaked back then, and they were following up Hannibal, which showed the removal of Ray Liotta's skull, and they're eating his brain and cooking his brain. I think they felt an obligation to match that because it was part of that continuity. So I think that's part of it. But I think the subtleties in Manhunter are definitely better, and they execute just as strongly, if not better than Red Dragon.
Yeah, I think it's different, but I think people who, like you said, I would say the vast majority of people saw Silence of the Lambs first, and then maybe they heard about this, and went, like the people who didn't read the books, like people who just, because Silence of the Lambs made $400 million or something ridiculous. Like, for the 90s. So a ton of people saw it. So they probably saw that, and then some of them went back and watched Manhunter. And they're very different. Like, they're both excellent movies. I was just curious, on a quick side note, because you asked people on a Twitter poll. So did you like this movie better? Or did you like Red Dragon better?
I think the cast is better in Red Dragon. I have to be fair to myself, and I probably have to watch Red Dragon in full again.
Oh, okay.
To give a full answer on that. But the more we're hashing it out and really talking about the meat and potatoes of why Michael Mann did what he did, and I feel like you're going to bat for him more than I am, but you're convincing me, is just the quality of him as a director is way stronger than Brett Ratner. And let's remind the audience that this was a Brett Ratner 4 years before X-Men The Last Stand, which pretty much single-handedly almost killed that whole franchise after one of the better sequels of the comic book genre.
Yeah, that'll be a fun conversation to have down the road someday. Like the whole, how the X-Men was really good, then it got shitty, then it got really good again, then it got shitty again. Like,
and now Wolverine's in Deadpool, so.
They don't even, man. The comic thing That was like a golden goose, and they just fucking cut its throat in front of everybody. Like,
Marvel's, they're starting to feel it now.
Yeah, I mean, it was always DC who was confused, and now Marvel's totally lost. Real quick, the Marvels that's coming out, the it was supposed to be the Captain Marvel 2 movie, but people didn't like Brie Larson, so they put in the other Captain Marvels. They cut that shit to like 93 minutes or something.
No way.
I told my brother that, and his jaw went slack. Like, he couldn't believe it. Like, a Marvel movie, 93 minutes? It's like...
Your brother went full Brian Cox, Hannibal Lecter?
You're going like, that's Master of Disguise territory. Like, if you're going, like, close to 90 minutes or under 90 minutes, that's not a blockbuster movie.
Yeah, I mean, Wikipedia says it's an hour and 40.
Maybe with trailers.
Yeah, but I know the early returns on the tickets are not looking promising for a budget that is apparently upwards of $280 million.
Yeah, it's going to be... They think it might be a bigger flop than The Flash, which is crazy.
Well, I don't want to get too into these current IPs and what they're exactly doing with them, but...
Well, they're shooting 2.5 movies. They're like, they shoot a whole movie, they fuck it up, they reshoot almost the entire thing, so they're basically paying for 2 movies, and then they release it.
Yeah, but also I feel like when they have these, like, a Kevin Feige in place or whatever, they punt a little bit on, like, big-name established directors, and they're just like, we're just going to make this work. Like, the guy who directed the Spider-Man, John Watts, I don't think he ever directed a movie before. And they're like, he's just going to direct Spider-Man now, and then it makes $1 billion, and away you go.
Yeah, and then I heard the woman they got to direct the Marvels, I think her name's Nia DaCosta, she just fucked off and directed another movie during post-production.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah.
I mean, I saw an interview. I mean, we're going on a tangent here.
But I
saw an interview with Brie Larson maybe around the time they were making the Marvels, and they were like, are you going to come back and play Carol Danvers again? And she's like, I don't know. Do people want me to?
Yeah.
Like, and I was like, oof, man. Damn. These people get really upset about this stuff. Meanwhile, I'm sure she's living quite the nice life.
Yeah, you got to think about it, though. If you were an actor 25 years ago, people didn't have this access to you. Like, you couldn't... Yeah. If people... like. It doesn't matter if, like, say like 70% of people like you and 30% people don't. Now, I think that's not the case with Brie Larson, but I'm not going to get into the specifics. But if 30% of everybody hates you, that's a lot of shit you got to read. Like,
that's that's true.
That's a lot of YouTube comments under the trailer for your latest film. But we are not here to talk about the probably impending doom of comic book films.
One thing I'll give some punk rock credit to that I, in my research of this film, I noticed that I read that William Peterson said they had to do some like guerrilla style filmmaking.
Yeah,
where I guess United Airlines or whatever the airline ones was didn't give them permission to do any sort of production on a commercial jet. So they had to get extra tickets, and they had to do like some clever ways in which they were filming it. So when you go back and watch the scene of Graham falling asleep on the plane, just know that that was done without approval. It was done on a legit flight, and it was done in obviously the pressure of knowing, you know, they couldn't be seen doing it. They had probably had to be very careful and like waiting for a flight attendant to be down the other side of the plane.
Well, I mean, the flight crew caught onto it, but they gave them jackets and like made them part of the crew. They gave them crew jackets and
not ideal conditions for trying to capture a scene, I'm sure. But the fact that that type of thing wouldn't be a hurdle today is another element that you have to put into the fact for a movie that was made, you know, 37 years ago for probably without a lot of muscle. It's not like Steven Spielberg was filming a movie and he was on the plane. They're like, oh, why don't you just take over the whole plane? We'll just kick everybody out.
Yeah, they just went on a red eye flight, and they were just going from one location they had to go to another one anyway. So it kind of it was like those stories are always a little amusing. The whole you know, where there's a will, there's a way type of thing. Like, oh, we got to go there anyway. Let's just smuggle on our cameras as carry on equipment. And if people say anything, we'll just give them swag. That'll shut people up. People love free shit
that they'll never wear.
Especially ever. Sky waitresses. I know. Flight attendants love that description, like sky wenches.
Bring on the sexy stews, man. Apparently, both movies had the same cinematographer, though.
Yeah. We can talk about the cinematography a little bit, because one of the things that I thought was goofy as hell until I saw that they did it intentionally was how out of sync that last sequence is, how it goes, like, it's really choppy, and then sometimes it's really fast, and then it slows down. And apparently they did that on purpose to try to create this chaotic environment, because, I mean, you want to talk about a situation going from... I mean, that situation escalates extremely quickly. Like, dude just jumps through the window, he cuts his face, throws him into a refrigerator.
Yeah.
And then he just picks up a shotgun and just starts mowing people down. It's like, Jesus, that fucking... Because the movie, as we've mentioned several times, so I hope we're not beating the point of the ground, it's pretty restrained and pretty grounded, and then it just like goes crazy at the end.
Off the rails. Yeah, completely off the rails at the end. Yeah,
yeah, and when you compare that
glass,
to your...
I'm like, in real life, he's bouncing off that.
Yeah.
And he's like getting hurt. Like, you're not just going through a house's pane glass wall. That's just not happening.
Yeah, but like, it, actually, when you compare it to the original ending for Red Dragon, it's actually, again, it's a more realistic version, because that was so crazy, and that was like a two-parter, that ending.
Yeah, the
fake out. But yeah, we did. You mentioned Joan Allen's character, because, like, again, you have the little research stuff. Like, William Peterson fought, like, he kind of embedded himself with the Chicago police to kind of get a feel for it, which is pretty cool. As we mentioned, Dennis Farina was already a Chicago detective. So you said he always kind of brings that stiff, kind of authoritarian energy to just about any part he plays, which is pretty interesting. And then Joan Allen, she worked with the New York Institute for the Blind, I think, to try to... And she would, like, walk around New York with... to really commit to it. I think she did a good job with it. I think... I thought it was funny in this movie, though, how they characterize blind women as kind of loose. I don't know if I really care for that. It's always been my experience. It's the deaf chicks that are just down for whatever. And if they find that offensive, well, they're not listening anyway.
So. Oh, there it is. Oh, jeez. I'm going to get... someone to just transcribe this whole entire segment, and then I'll post the text version to, like,
I'm just kidding.
Charity sites for deaf women.
Yeah, like, I'm cool. I'm cool enough to have fooled around with a deaf chick. Come on,
with your home address on it, and then you just have a bunch of deaf chicks showing up at your house, like, Michael, why did you say
this? Jesus.
Anyway,
it's like signing at me angrily. I'm like, I don't know what that is.
You just close your blinds. They're still yelling at you. You just turn up Black Number One louder on your stereo. Oh, man.
All right. A little levity. You know, we've been talking about murder and criminal profiling for...
little levity. Speaking of which, Peter Steele would have been a great Francis Dolarhyde. I think that was a missed opportunity. But anyway, Peter Steele being the now deceased lead singer of Typo Negative, who stood at a 6'7", 6'8" statuesque
just jacked,
figure.
Jacked to the gills, coke to the gills.
Coke, roids, black hair dye.
Dead at 50.
Dead at 50. Sepsis. All right, back to Manhunter. Yeah, Joan Allen, who I think a lot of people probably know her for... a lot of roles, you know, the bitchy mom in Notebook, among other things. But
wasn't she in Pleasantville too?
Yeah. I thought she did a good job as well. I think overall, and Kim Greist, I thought was good too. small part, but as Molly Graham. Didn't care for the son. I thought that kid was a... I can't imagine that kid went on to act.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir on the whole like child actor thing.
That kid, yeah, that kid.
I mean, I barely like real kids, let alone child actors.
Yeah, that kid went into cable repair like 5 years after this movie came out. Chris Elliott showing up as was that dude born 45? Chris Elliott, no matter how old he is, always looked the same. Like that guy was born bald, and he had a brief role in it. I don't know how many other cameos I spotted in this one, but I remember seeing Chris Elliott pop in there.
Yeah, I was kind of taken aback by that too. He was one of the fingerprint guys, I think.
Yeah. He was just he was in the station. Just all of a sudden, oh, it's Chris Elliott. There he is, unchanged.
I don't know if he was the Jimmy Price part or not, because Jimmy Price is kind of like one of the recurring characters. He's kind of like a supporting character from the novels, and then he shows up in some of the other movies and the TV shows.
He played Brian Zeller, and Dan Butler played Jimmy Price.
Oh, okay.
So that's your Jimmy Price. And then I just looked that up. I did not know that offhand.
Well, I didn't either, so I...
Well, there are times when I'm like, he's got to be reading something, and you're not. You're not at all.
This is not one of those times. But, so we've gotten into the kind of the story, the different portrayals. I mean... I don't know. What else do you think there is to discuss about Manhunter? I mean, I think we've appropriate kind of laid out our opinions about the, you know, kind of taking this material, which is kind of, you know, it's really crazy. I mean, it's really, really out there, and it's based on... I didn't do a ton of research about Thomas Harris. Like I said, I know that basically all of his novels, except for one, have become movies. Like, he only really did the Hannibal Lecter movies. He did one after it that I can't remember the name of that came out a couple years ago. And before that, he did a movie called Black Sunday, which was a terrorist movie. Mm-hmm. And it was like a plot to blow up the Super Bowl type of thing.
Oh, love it.
Robert Shaw was in the film. So
love Robert Shaw.
You want to see Robert Shaw play an Israeli commando, watch Black Sunday.
Excellent.
But
one thing I will say is that I think what may have hurt the movie more than people will realize is the music. I do not think this movie had a great score. And I would be lying if I said I knew who Michel Rubini was. It doesn't look like there's a giant resume here. But it felt, you know how like that you compare the scores for The Terminator and T2, and there's just a more modernized classic score feel to T2 versus T1, which has a very synthy, new wavy sound to it. There is that here too, with a very mono sounding synthy type of score that I think hurts some of the scenes, because I mean, a score will lift or hurt a scene no matter what type of movie you're in. And I feel like some of the performances by the actors in this movie were damaged a bit by the really now dated sounding synthy score.
And some of the pop songs they used. Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. I know we usually pick movies and we kind of praise individual aspects all the way around. I think I'm kind of with you. I thought the music was kind of incongruent with what was going on the screen. And I also agree with your evaluation that it was kind of a product of the time, because you got the guy from Miami Vice. You know, you got Michael Mann, who was pretty famous for doing Miami Vice, and that they actually wanted Don Johnson. That's who the studio wanted to be Will Graham. Imagine?
I don't know about that one.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe it would have been the Matthew McConaughey and True Detective breakthrough before we ever saw it. Like, everybody thinks of Don Johnson. It's like, hey, I'm so, like, handsome. Why would anything ever fucking bother me? But then he decides to, like, you know, turn on the capital A acting. It's like everybody back up, about to act the shit out of this. And everybody's like, give Mr. Johnson some space. And he's in a fucking smoking jacket.
You too, Bruce.
Shut the fuck up, Bruce.
But instead of looking for fucking the Tooth Fairy the whole time, he would have been looking for a heartbeat, and we wouldn't want that to happen, would we?
And then they had that cheesy heartbeat song in this.
Motherfucker.
Yeah. But,
God damn.
Yeah, that's definitely not... I mean, on one hand, I would be kind of intrigued to see how that played out, but on the other, I think it would have not been great.
But, yeah.
Timothy Dalton either. It's like, is he just going to be British? You're just going to make this character... He's just going to be British? Like, I'm sure
Look,
Timothy
we're not
Dalton...
Gonna say,
what?
We're not going to say anything bad about Timothy Dalton because he starred alongside Fran Drescher
in The Beautician and the Beast. Yeah, it always comes back to that.
Fucking
that's like the first time it's ever happened. Like, pretending like it happens every fucking time we talk.
It's like we have an archivist. They're like, that's the 17th Beautician and the Beast reference on Just Like the Movies. A movie from 1997 that nobody watched.
I think I watched it. I remember the only part I remember is when she's like, he's all pissed off about something. She's looking at him. She goes, are your sideburns uneven? And then she's just fucking cutting his hair in the next scene.
I fucking love you, Fran Drescher. My God. Keep fighting the fight for the Screen Actors Guild.
What would you have thought about Fran Drescher in the Reva part?
Oh, I would have loved
just
it.
Just a blind chick is free with her body.
Yeah. I mean, better than Fran Drescher if she were deaf, I guess. That would have been tough to handle.
Well, if she was playing a deaf chick, this would have like, you know, been X-rated. Like, no one would have saw it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't even gotten a distributor.
Oh,
just
man.
Deaf Fran Drescher giving Tom Noonan a fucking rusty trombone while he's watching his home movies. The fuck? What am I doing?
It'd be funny if it was set up like The Nanny, where it's just like Francis Dolarhyde is the Mr. Sheffield, and that's the only thing that's different. You just get Tom Noonan in there, all freaking tall and doofy and age well beyond his mid-30s. Yeah. No offense.
Sure. Sure.
What else has this dude been in, though, that's like... and not even like, oh, he played a guy reading a newspaper in...
He was the one of the villains in Last Action Hero. He was the Ripper in that. He was in...
He's fucking Frankenstein in the Monster Squad. That makes sense. That's up his alley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in Heat, too. He shows up... He's like one of those... you know how we talk about how directors, they like to use the same actors when they can? I think Tom Noonan shows up in a disproportionate amount of Michael Mann films.
Yeah, he is in Heat. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, he's Kelso.
Kelso, yeah. Oh, interesting. Interesting, very interesting indeed.
This information's beamed out all over the place. You just got to know how to grab it.
You just got to find it. That's all. Yeah, I'm not trying to dog on the guy too much. It just, I don't know.
I think part of it is because the Francis Dolarhyde character, a big part of it is that he thinks he, this is the movie's choice and I support it for the most part, but it doesn't really develop the Dolarhyde character all that well, as opposed to if you've seen Red Dragon or you've seen the portrayal of Francis Dolarhyde on the Hannibal TV show. It gets way more into the fact that he was abused, and he thinks he's so ugly because he has that cleft palate. He has that scar. He has that hair lip scar, and so he compensates for that by lifting weights. And he's like really ripped up. And they did a better job of that with Ralph Fiennes and Red Dragon, but in this one, I guess Tom Noonan did lift weights. But as we can both attest, it's much more difficult. I mean, The Rock is a counterexample, but there's when you're a long limb guy, it's a lot more difficult to put on muscle and like lift heavy weights.
Unless you're Peter Steele.
And yeah, there's always a counterexample, and usually those people are enhanced. But
and between her thighs. Oh. No, yeah. Yeah, I mean fair point there. Yeah. It's not hating on the actor or anything. I just think because of, you know, Red Dragon and Ralph Fiennes, I think is probably a much better actor than Tom Noonan. It's just sort of like what you said. It's just that they happen to capture that maybe a bit more accurate to what they're looking for. And I don't know if that is because of how the series got lifted by the success of Silence of the Lambs, because then you watch Hannibal, and that is very like classical, very high drama, high theater. You know, the scenery is just has this classic feel to it. It feels like it's more of this like prestige artistic film. And then you go to Red Dragon, which is the third of those, and they probably had to try to hold some sort of court for the continuity of how the story flows with Hannibal Lecter. So even though it's a, you know, a prequel to Silence of the Lambs. So Manhunter was just on its own. And I don't know that, you know, I'm not a historian on psychological thrillers necessarily, but I mean, aside from some Hitchcock stuff, and, you know, I'm sure there's tons of other stuff, but I don't think it had, it didn't have the opportunities that Red Dragon had coming off of two pretty relatively popular movies to slot in and do a third one. I think there's more pressure on Michael Mann to do his than there's pressure on Brett Ratner to do his at that point. So, I mean, that's just my take on it. And I think Michael Mann also, like we've sort of concluded, used some of his more subtleties to go over things, whereas Brett Ratner just went a little big in some areas.
Yeah, I think he definitely like took a lot of cues from what Jonathan Demme did in Silence of the Lambs, and as I said, they got more into the Great Red Dragon backstory, like the whole thing with the painting and all that stuff. They didn't do any of that in this one, which I kind of like it better, but at the same time, I do recognize there's some deficiencies and there's some stuff that doesn't make sense. And there was one other thing I wanted to mention since you brought up the soundtrack that I thought was interesting, because I always thought it didn't fit the movie at all until I, because I know you said you said you didn't really like the soundtrack and blah blah blah, which I don't entirely disagree with. I just didn't want to put you in a spot where you're like, what did you think of this? And then I just tell you the real reason.
Oh,
why
yeah,
it's in
no,
it. So,
yeah.
The inclusion of Inagata DeVita at the end, where that was, that might seem like it doesn't fit, or maybe it's just to create this kind of weird atmosphere because he was turning on the music super loud so she wouldn't be able to hear him moving around. It kind of like disoriented his blind prisoner, but I always thought that was goofy. I don't know why. It just didn't make sense to me. It didn't fit with the whole... I don't know why I thought it was... Because there were a couple other pop songs that Michael Mann wanted to use, and he wanted to use Comfortably Numb, but he couldn't get the rights for it. So they ended up having to shoehorn in one of those original compositions you were such a fan of. But
yeah.
but the Inagata DeVita thing, that never sat quite right with me until I was reading for this movie that... Part of Michael Mann's research was he talked to this serial killer in Texas. Or I don't know if he's a serial killer. I think he only killed one woman. But he had this delusion that they were in love and that was their song. Ugh. So he took that piece from his research and put it in the movie. So I was like, I thought that made it a little more interesting to me. I don't know if that really does anything for you, but I thought it was an interesting little factoid.
No, yeah, I have no problem with that. It's not even so much the popular music that was chosen. It really is just the score that they developed just felt way too of its time, synth heavy. And I think when you're trying to tell a psychological thriller, it works then, because like I brought up Twin Peaks before, it's the same type of thing, even though Twin Peaks is more tongue-in-cheek than this. This is way more serious. It just... As time has moved on and music has changed and or maybe even gone back to a more analog classical style of scores, it feels like the movie aged poorly because of just the music. And that's not their fault, because that was what was going at that time. It just happened to be that type of music, at least for me anyway, doesn't... I don't think it helps this type of movie. Like, if this was... Like we talked about Commando and how absurd the score was for Commando. How it the steel drums and then the synth here and all this shit.
Steamy
but it worked,
sax.
super steamy. Sexy, steamy sex. I mean, everyone's nipples were hard that whole movie, but like Bob Costas in basketball. But I guess my point is, because Commando is a bit of a ridiculous movie where we don't even like to really think about it. We talked about it and joked about it, but it didn't hurt the movie because it's this kind of a ridiculous movie where this is more of a, you know, there is over the top elements of it, but it's more serious subject matter.
It's dark subject matter. And it's,
and then when you're like, it's just, I don't know, man. I just, it just, and it doesn't mean the movie was bad. I still like the movie. I'll probably watch it again. I think Brian Cox, for the limited time he was on screen, crushed it. I think Michael Mann made great choices, and I think he out-directed Brett Ratner, who had more resources. And also, like I said, you know, it's like, you know, following a big band or a big comedian, you're going to have the crowd already warmed up for you. And Brett Ratner had that because of Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal. So you got to give credit to Michael Mann for what he did. I'm not saying he's like some punk rock director or anything, but I think he likes to make his movies his way, and I have respect for that. And I think as I get older and learn more about why certain movies are made certain ways and directors do certain things, I'm no film scholar, but I appreciate it more.
Yeah, there was a whole thing that I was going to get into with, because you brought up Dante Spinotti, I think his name is. He was the cinematographer on this, and coincidentally Red Dragon,
yeah,
like 15 years later. But when some of the stuff I noticed and some of the stuff I read, but like one of the things I read that I'm going to feel like an idiot for this, and you guys can feel free to correct me on our various social media platforms, you know, at Just the Movies on X, Just Like the Movies Pod on Instagram, any of those things. But they talked about the use of mise-en-scene, which is like something about blocking a scene so it's like in and of itself. Like you mentioned the thing about the jail cell, mm-hmm. but I didn't really get that. So if anybody could explain that to somebody who's deficient in picking up concepts like that, I'd really appreciate it. But like one of the things they mentioned was how the cinematographer used different colors. Now, some of them were really obvious. Like anytime Will Graham was with his wife, it was in blue. But then they had like green and magenta for like scenes involving, and it would be in the clothes and things like that. So it was like little things like that that maybe you wouldn't notice watching it, but then you hear about them maybe when you watch it again. By the way, how did you watch this movie? What did you find it on?
I had a friend loan it to me.
Yeah, I also watched it on a privately managed online repository, but one of our stalwart listeners, he goes by CalTurk4 on Twitter. He responded to us and he said that there's basically just a YouTube video that's the whole movie if you want to watch it. So thanks to him, you know, this show's favorite Australian Canadian, I think he's back in Australia, transplant, but we hope you're doing well, and thanks for that, because I didn't want this to turn into another fucking PCU debacle.
And we're gonna talk about this movie and none of you could fucking watch it unless buy it for $30 on Amazon. God,
just remember the movie as it was and then we'll discuss it. But
Manhunter is good, man. I'm not gonna sit here and say it's one of my favorite movies, but we only have a certain amount of favorite movies in our lives, and
say it too much, it starts to lose meaning.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yes, the hyperbole is real these days.
No, I enjoyed it a lot. It's definitely my second favorite Hannibal Lecter movie.
Did you have Silence of the Lambs is the first?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was gonna try to do something goofy as a bit, but like that wouldn't even been worth the payoff.
I mean, we'll do Silence of the Lambs one day, so I'll save a certain bit for that. I'm sure you know exactly what that bit is. But did you have a favorite scene or moment or anything from
this
movie?
I mentioned a couple scenes that struck me more when I was watching it. Like I said, the scene where he pieces it all together is kind of like the payoff in the movie, where it's like, this is why they brought this guy in, because he has these crazy... And I hate this word, because of that show. I actually like the show, but I hate how they overuse the word insights in that show Mindhunter that was on Netflix. Mm-hmm. A show like, and, you know, a show that might not have been, you know, if this movie hadn't kind of like laid the tracks, it's like you weren't really seeing a lot of procedural stuff in that, in during that time. And the whole science, the whole psychological aspect of you know, profiling and all that stuff, that wasn't really, just that kind of legacy that it left was pretty crazy if you really think about it. But like I said, I think my, like, one of my favorite scenes was him kind of like losing it a little bit, but not, like you said, he didn't do it as good as Michael Keaton, but it was a good scene, I think, because of the way it contrasted with how calm everybody generally was.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's, again, that's another kind of trademark of Michael Mann's direction. It's like everything's very businesslike. It, like, there's dramatic moments, but it's kind of like when people watch Mad Men, and like Mad Men was, there weren't these crazy dramatic moments all the time because it was trying to be more like, more grounded in reality. Like, and then in this movie, it was kind of the same thing. Like, you're dealing with this ridiculous concept, but even when he does the thing where he gives the interview to antagonize the Tooth Fairy to try to draw him out, and then he's walking the route, and the guy's talking to him, and real matter of fact, he goes, yeah, you got the second chance armor on, and he says something like, well, he just kind of shrugs, and he goes, well, what'd you do that? Or like, what, you don't think it's going to work? He goes, well, 8 out of 11 times, he went for the headshot. And he just says it like, it's like, if this guy shows up, there's a 73% chance he's just going to shoot me in the fucking head anyway. So, but no, I like the epiphany scene. I kind of like his first walkthrough scene. I'm kind of with you. I didn't really like the scene with his kid, even though that's kind of important for his development or whatever. But you know how I feel about that whole thing. But what about you?
Yeah.
Did you? And of course the ending, because I thought the ending was super cool. Because they had to have they had to punctuate some action with it, and then they got into all the geeky shit with the special bullets and all that stuff. But yeah. Did you have a scene that stood out for you?
I mean, it's gonna be cliche, but I really do think it's the jail cell sort of jockeying for position between Lecter and Graham, and you feel the history there without needing to get too much of an understanding of the backstory on those two. But it's clearly the ego of Lecter and wanting that ego to be fed, wanting to feel wanted to help, wanting to feel like he is respected as this genius. But at the same time being told that he's insane. That line where he says, "Dream much, Will?" You know, to try to get under his skin, and brings up his family, and you know that it's sort of like he's trying to still have some sense of power over Will, even though he's trapped in that tiny cell. And they do a good job of really creating claustrophobia in that scene. So, and I just like Brian Cox a lot. So I'm sure a lot of people will pick that as probably their favorite scene, but I really do like the tug of war between those two characters, two very different people. But for some reason there is this odd sort of respect or bond between the two of them. I think that would go with that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I know this wasn't one of our longer conversations, but I felt like it was substantive and deep and meandering, like a BJ from a deaf chick. Was that one too many?
What? I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, God. We better stop there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to get a letter in the mail for the fucking ACLU.
No. We're just having fun, as they used to do. All right, so what? I got to pick a movie, right?
Yeah, you do. What are you thinking, man? Are you thinking you're going to stay thematically relevant, or are you going to go for one of our jarring tonal shifts?
I'm going to go for a movie that is, I kept saying, well, at least not kept saying, but there was a few times on this episode where I said, you know, Manhunter's not one of my favorite movies, but I'm going to pick one of my favorite movies, a movie that's in my top 10 of all time. It is post Y2K, so it's more of a modern feel, but it's 17 years old. Has one of my favorite twists of all time, and we've already done a couple of his movies now, but it's time to revisit Christopher Nolan in the 2006 The Prestige.
I'll bone up on my prestidigitation.
Oh, all right. Yes.
Sleight of hand, layman.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yep. It's a word that means sleight of hand that has more fucking syllables than sleight of hand.
Using a bloody devil.
No, that should be fun. I haven't seen that in a while. Plus, I was kind of lamenting the other day. I was talking to one of my friends about Christopher Nolan and how I used to like his films so much, and I couldn't even get it up to go watch Oppenheimer. Like, I
haven't seen the last couple of his movies.
Yeah,
I'll be honest.
I think he went from, I don't want to get too into it, but like, he used to come up with these great stories that were kind of unique, and they had his little field. Like, every director has their own brand. Like, we talked kind of at length about Michael Mann's brand. Like, he's always going to have professionals working under stress, and he's going to have a certain vernacular, certain things that he uses. But it seems like after a while, after Inception, it seemed like he got kind of sick of doing that, and then he went from doing that, finishing out the Batman movies, and then Interstellar, and then he just went straight into, like, historical biopic stuff. Like historical period dramas. It seems like he's been doing that ever since Interstellar came out. I mean, I might be wrong, but he did Dunkirk. Oh, he did Tenet, but people hated that. I didn't even see that.
I didn't see Tenet. I saw Dunkirk. I thought that was pretty good. But Tenet, and I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet, though you hear great things about that, too. But yeah, Prestige, I remember seeing in the theater. I have a very funny story about seeing that movie in the theater that I'll get into. But a movie that just blew me away. And it's one of those movies that I like introducing people to, because for whatever reason, it's not like the most popular movie in the world, though I think it's very good.
Yeah, so, and it was weird because it's one of those things where studios, the whole, like, competitive intelligence that goes on at studios, like, they, like, 20th Century Fox, here's Warner Brothers is doing, like, a movie about this, and, like, oh, we have to do that movie now. Because The Illusionist came out a couple months before this.
Right around it.
Yeah. It was the same year, but I think The Prestige came out in the fall. And
Edward Norton, right?
Illusionist? Yeah, The Illusionist came out in the summer. I think the funny thing was, I think I saw The Illusionist in the theater, but I didn't see The Prestige. And when I saw The Prestige, I was like, why the fuck did I see this in the theater? What's the matter with me?
Yeah. It's in my top 10. So I hope you enjoyed on the rewatch, and I hope everyone likes the pick. But if not, my apologies, The Prestige up next. I'm excited to talk about that. But I enjoyed talking about Manhunter. I think, with this movie, the plot was pretty simple. So we did talk a lot about, how it was made, and we did some comparative stuff. So I did enjoy talking about the movie, and it made me, want to check it out again after the discussion, because, you brought up some points that made me think twice about a few things that I came into critically that now I think are actually good. So I've shifted in an hour and 20 minutes. I've shifted my thoughts on some of the things on this.
So it was a good, productive discussion. We're building consensus. Yeah, that's nice.
It was a delightful chat.
I agree. And yes. Now I wanted to, I don't know if anybody's watched. Did you ever watch the Hannibal TV show?
No.
I'd give it a chance. I mean, like I said, there's a certain level of, some of the criticisms we leveled at the whole Hannibal Lecter mythos. Like, there's a little bit of, some affectations are, it's a little affected and dramatic, and a little over the top. But the season, they only did three seasons because there was some kind of conflict. They were going to keep going, but there was some kind of conflict with the rights for Silence of the Lambs. And but the second season finale is like one of the greatest episodes of TV I've ever seen. It's incredible.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, I like Mads Mikkelsen, so...
Mads Mikkelsen, Jack Crawford's played by Lawrence Fishburne, and then Hugh Dancy, who a lot of people... is not exactly a household name, but he was one of the finalists to play the Joker, I think, in The Dark Knight.
Oh, wow.
He didn't make the cut, but I think he was one of the guys that was in the mix but he's the one who plays Will Graham in it.
He's married to Claire Danes.
Oh, that's right. Can you imagine? It's like he just says something like, hey, did you leave this glass here? And she just starts like fucking sobbing hysterically. Like,
she's just like, I'm Claire Danes.
She's just like, like the lip just starts quivering and he's just like, oh God.
You gonna do that Juliet shit again? It was 28 years ago. I was in Terminator 3. Now we're just shitting on Claire Danes for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
The epilogue
of
this episode.
I think it's time to fucking wrap it up.
Let's get out of here before we get in more trouble with the Claire Danes fandom.
I'm going to get a letter from Gallaudet in the mail.
Yeah. Yeah. My so-called life fan club is going to come after us. I think she was on that show, right? Anyway.
Yes.
Thank you, everybody, for listening and being a part of what we've got going on here, Just Like the Movies. As Mike said, appreciate you standing by as we shifted our schedule just a wee bit, but the consistency remains, and we are here to talk about the movies we love from yesteryear, though we are bringing it up a bit closer with 2006 The Prestige next. So if you dig what we do here, make sure you tell a friend who also likes movies. Send them a link. It's free to listen to our podcast, and we hope you've been enjoying what we are doing here. So from me and Mike here at Just Like the Movies, we hope you're all doing well, better than my wife's car, which pretty much just died on contact.
Oh, man, that sucks.
Yeah, the engine just went gone. Anyway, hopefully next time we're doing an episode, I tell you about this next vehicle that we have and things are looking brighter and better. But you all, be kind, rewind, relax, see you around.
We are issued our natures.
Give me a